Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk, a show dedicated to exploring all aspects of creating a great dental office, where the only dumb question is the question that's not asked. Here's Jim and Han.
Good evening, Jim Jarvis here, along with my co-host Han Tran. Han, how are you this evening?
I'm doing swell, Jim, just absolutely swell. How about you?
Doing well. We're hanging in there. Weather's changing a little bit in northwestern Ohio. We had some cool evenings, but, you know, cannot complain. So tonight we've got an interesting show, kind of segues with last week's topic, and basically it fits in nicely. It's Straight Talk episode number 88. The question is, why? Why do I need to do this? And then fill in the blank, 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 blank. You know, Han and I hear so many times, we hear so many questions, you know, one of which was last week's show, who's responsible for this? And then the other is, why do I need to do this? So we felt it's important that, you know, again, our goal is not to sit here and tell you what to do. That's not where we're here. You know, that's really not what we're made of. That's not how we think. Our way of looking at things is we're going to tell you what we believe. We're going to give you the facts around it. We're going to give you the reasons behind it. And we're going to say, you make your decision based on how you make decisions. You have to be comfortable with that. So as part of that decision-making process, it's always very natural to say, why do I need to do this? Or why do I need to do that? Or can I just do this? And it is really important. And again, over the years, Han and I have always felt that, you know, we believe that a well-educated decision maker has a much better chance of heading in the right direction and making the right decisions and heading in the right path. And that's the reason why we do these shows. That's why we're putting this information out. And Han, you said it. Everybody uses what we give, even our competitors, if you want to call them that, the people that are in the same kind of pseudo business that we are. And, you know, they use all this information that we put out there. That's fine. We don't have a problem with it. Because if anything, it helps to educate even that many more people, decision makers, on the issues and the facts. You know, you guys are great at dealing with dentistry. But I can pretty much feel comfortable in saying, Han, wouldn't you say that not very many of them, the dentists and their clients out there, are really well versed in dealing with architecture and design and construction. Maybe a few, but not the majority.
That is correct. I think there is a small fraction of the dentists that I deal with or communicate with on a regular basis are hands-on guys and gal, you know, very capable with DIY. Tasks and stuff like that. And once in a while, they're kind of honest, you know, we have honest conversation and they say, I think I bit too much and I couldn't chew it off. And, yeah. You know, and things like that. So, the whole thing is, like Jim said, that a well-informed client or individual, they make better decisions. They make better decisions that could help lead the entire team to be more productive, to be on schedule, to be on budget. Because if you have a client, a smart client, but who are not well-versed and not informed in the topic matter, and they can drag their feet, and then they suddenly, you know, that 6 months or that 4 months build out period, 3 or 4 months build out period becomes 6 or 8, or that 9 to 12 months, building a new building could be 14, 16, 18 months. So when they're informed and they're comfortable with it, they can make better decisions. So we provide, based on our personal experience, based on our combined experience, we put our knowledge on the table. You get to pick and choose what's right for you. Okay, and that will help you, no matter who gets to do the project, whether it's us or somebody else, you make the right decision for yourself based on the things you learn. And that's why we do this, because one, we're just knowledge and architecture junkies, and we love this. Okay,
and we're passionate about it. We're passionate about that. I guess I'm going to get into a little philosophical realm here for just a few seconds, so bear with me. But, you know, it's like we want to challenge the norm and think a little differently. There's got to be a better way, and we want to be that better way to create an environment that helps you get your final solution. That final solution, of course, is into a project or into a facility, whether it's a renovation or a new build or anything else in between, that fits your budget, that is not this ultra stressful kind of process. It's done quickly. It saves you money. It saves you time. And it's basically a joy to experience, because you're probably only going to do it once, maybe twice in your whole career. Odds are you won't be doing it more than that. I mean, just a very small handful of our clients have done it 2 or 3 or 4 times. So, you know, that's why we feel very strongly about helping you. And when we say be informed or be well educated in this process, because you're probably only going to do it one time or two times. So that's what's crucial. We think it is very crucial that to give you all the facts, kind of why we call our show Straight Talk. Basically, we're just going to be straight with you, and we're going to give you the facts, give you the reasons behind them. And I guess our big thing is we do not want to say this is what you should do. You should do this and just, you know, how is a lot of times, you know, just shut up and do it, right? Well, no, that's not what we're all about. So that little bit of philosophy, let's jump into some of the things, the questions that we hear very often is, you know, the whys. And Han and I were talking before the show, and we had so many of them, we had to whittle it down, because you know how we like to talk. So it's like, what can we fit in within an hour? So we're going to jump real quick into the one called, why do I need a conceptual site plan? Well, Han, I'll let you start off with one. What the heck is a conceptual site plan?
Yeah, a conceptual site plan would be what we would say like a preliminary design of, equate to the preliminary design of a building. It's fluid. You can still tweak and stuff like that, but it applies to the design, the layout of the site. Okay. It's not as simple as, here I got this plot of land. We plunk a building on it. We put the parking lot around it, and that's it, right? No, it's a lot more complicated than that. And because you still have efficiency that you have to look at, you still have functionality to look at. A piece of property poorly laid out could be a major problem. Okay, here's things that you don't often look at or think about when you drive into, let's say, a shopping center. If you are If you live in the north where there's snow, the individual who designed the site, whether it's yours or a shopping center, you have to think, okay, when the city come to pick up the trash, how would they come into the site? Where is at the ideal location for the dumpster to be on the site for them to easily get to it and get off the site? Most of us don't think about it, but when you design a site, you have to do that. As a building owner, you say, oh my God, I don't want it to be at the front door. So what is the compromise? So we have to look at that. You know, how far does my staff have to walk from the building to the dumpster and back in the middle of the winter and all that. So the convenience, the function, circulations, all that got to be taking place. You know, where is it best for the staff to park? Where is it best for the handicap parking space, the ramp? What is the best way to circulate around the building? And where exactly is ideal for the building to sit on the site? Is it closest to the road or far back? You know, so there's a lot of questions that's involved in the layout of the site. So the architectural site plan is a conceptual layout before the engineer, the civil engineer, get their hands on it. We identify based on the solar orientation, the visibility of the building, how do you service the building, where do you stock the snow, and all that good stuff. All of that ideas and questions have to be answered when we lay out the site. Is there an easement? What is the setback? Can you get curb cuts? How many? Should it be a one-way, two-way? All that stuff. So it's not simply I'm going to put a building on the site, we're going to pave it, and off we go.
Mm-hmm. So, well, you also deal with issues like, you know, go back to our podcast that talks about first impressions. The first impression that a patient has is driving up to your building, driving from wherever they're at to getting to the parking lot, driving around the parking lot, trying to find a parking space, if that is a particular issue. Or we all make decisions, we all make perceptions, and we all make judgments of and or on the quality of the service based upon things we like or don't like as we create these new first impressions. So here's a prime example. If I'm driving up to a facility and it becomes a giant rat maze for me to get to a parking spot within some close proximity to the front door of the building, I've already made a negative impression of that service provider, whatever they are. It could be anything. So we think about that. You need to think about that because it will either help you or hurt you. And just because of that little simple concept of how easy is it to get to the parking spots that allow them to get to the front door. And then the question of where is the front door? Okay. So the conceptual site plan also integrates a kind of a dovetail approach with the conceptual design of the building. Where is the best place for the front door? Okay, you've got everything to think about. One, you got to think about issues of the environment, sun, wind, snow, rain, all that kind of good stuff. That'll dictate sometimes where the front door might go. In the north, it's much better to have your front door on the south or the east portion of the building as opposed to it is to the north or the west, because the north and the west is where all the storms come from. And, you know, you don't want to turn around in the middle of the winter and have your front door being a place where the, you know, you've got a pile of snow racking up against the thing. So you got to think about that. Orientation of the building in relationship to the main entry. So if you're in a medical or a business office park, you might have limited exposure. We've got a project like that over in Illinois right now, where you can't come off of the main route. You're not allowed to have any curb cuts off that. You have to come in off a side corridor road, which then allows you to then to turn into actually into another road to get to the drive of the driveway entrance into the property and onto the parking lot. So in actuality, the back of the building faces the main road. And so it's a kind of different kind of approach, but you got to think about that stuff. When you're evaluating a piece of property, is it in fact what you would like to see? Or do you want, or are you the mindset to say, no, I want my front door facing the main street, and the main street is where all the people are going to see me in the exposure? Well, that has to be evaluated. And Han, I'm going to throw this at you. In regards to who's the best person to deal with this? You know, is it the realtor that's trying to sell you that piece of property?
No, I have not run into a broker. I don't care how many years they have been in the business of selling property or helping locate property. No, I have not run into one that came from the design arenas. Okay. Their interest, in my opinion, this is just my opinion for what it's worth. When you deal with people who sell, who rely their next meal to be on the success of the sales, they have a different motive than those who solve problems. So they may be the best individual to help locate a property based on, you know, the demographic, and all that stuff. But in terms of how a property is used, they would not be. Because once they sell the property, it is somebody else's problem to solve. And that somebody else's problem to solve would be your design team. And you are now the proud owner of a piece of land that are compromised in its ability and limit on how you can use it. We have plenty of example of what should not be done before you bought the property. See, once you buy the property and you bought all the headaches that come with it, okay? Even if you buy the property cheap, the seller or the broker, once you sign the deal and you pay for it, it's yours. They already got their money, and so it's your problem to deal with. We have clients that bought property because it's cheap and it has absolutely no legal access onto the property. None. No actual on-site parking. Okay, it was cheap as far as the purchase is concerned, but it was expensive to remedy those things. And it's limited remedies. You go to all possible scenario with all of the authority that allow you to do, to gain access into the site. The city can give you some, but when you're on a major roadway, it could be the Department of Transportation, and those people have very, very rigid guidelines. It's very difficult to get a yes answer for the things you really need. And it's become very frustrating, very expensive to buy a cheap property where you have to dump a lot of money in solving issues that should have been solved during the design of the site.
Right. And we haven't even got into the building. We have not even got into the building. We're already burning through a bunch of your money. So here's another question for you, Han. Is the general contractor the best person to help the dentist work through the site issues?
Let me say this kindly. Usually, regardless, it depends on how sophisticated they are. Again, majority of them that I have encountered throughout my career since 1983 are people, they may be engineer by training, but I have not run into one that's an architect or a civil engineer for that matter. They can help you through the process as far as the administrative, as you know, working through with the city and stuff like that. But again, the design of the site, that's not their, in general, it's not their forte. Can I answer your question?
Then lastly, is the civil engineer, you brought that up, is the civil engineer the best person to lead this process?
I think in general, civil engineers are really analytical problem solver when it comes to site. When I think their strongest point is to deal with water management. And so in term of designing the site, they probably, in my opinion, would be the second in line, ideally, who to do it. But I find that this is a little bit selfish in my, with the answer, is that the ideal individual to do the preliminary design of the site is the architect. Because they deal with the building, how the building is used.
You answered the question before I ask it, but yes, exactly. Go ahead.
Yeah, because the member of your project team is responsible for the building is the architect. Okay, how it's used, how to where it need to be, and how does it best position on the site. A relatively seasoned architect should know basically the lay of the land as far as the property. There is things that are crucial that most of them should know. You know, where's the utility come from? You know, where's it coming to the site? You know, electrical, sewage, water, and then how is the land, the topography for the land? As far as where's the water surface water flow. So ideal location for a detention, retention pond, and things like that. So, and then they look at circulations, access to the property. They have a very broad idea of how, you know, the crucial element that would make a successful site. And then that way, once they have a general idea and they can look, you know, place the building site and stuff like that, and that's when they have a more detailed conversation with the civil engineer, and the civil engineer would then design the site to handle the drainage and the utilities and all that good stuff that's associated with engineering. So it's a collaborative type of process. There isn't anybody on the project that do everything themselves, because nowadays it's hard to find anybody that say, hey, I can do everything. But the conceptual layout of the site is usually best done by the architect, and then he or she can bring in the necessary team member to fine tune it to make sure that everything works, based on the conceptual ideas. Jim?
Exactly. And Han, I guess I would add just a little point in that the site and the building need to be basically created in a cohesive way so that the design works so well together. You know, that's a mark of a very well thought out project. And you may say, well, why would I care about that? Well, the reason why you care about it is because it makes your life easier. It potentially will bring you in more revenue because of the psychology we talked about people and first impressions. But the other part about it is that it is with the correct kind of organization and the right group, i.e. the architect leading all this, you will get a better solution. And a better solution will equal a less costly overall project. So you'll either get more bang for your dollars, or you'll get a project that costs you less money. And Han, you brought up some of the prime examples of sites that weren't properly evaluated before purchase, and they cost the owner unbelievable amounts of money. And we're not talking about a couple thousand dollars. We're talking about tens of thousands of dollars and sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars that are thrown away or wasted that you never get back. You can never do anything other than just pay it and lick your wounds. And it's like, open up your checkbook. Oh, crap. Well, now I can't afford that piece of equipment that I wanted to put into my project because now I had to put an extra $100,000 in the site because it was, whatever was done improperly. So it does have a major financial ramification.
We're talking about raw land, putting a building on.
Raw land or a building that is an existing building of maybe a different use. Both of those have site issues. Yeah.
Actually, it's also applied to if you are a dentist looking at a location that already have a building on it. And you're going to be a tenant within, multiple tenant within that building. The layout of the land for the site layout play an important part for you as well. Okay, because here I participated in a discussion in the recent days about there's a Costco and. There is a location next door to the Costco facility. Is it a good idea or is it a bad idea? It's a great idea for the fact that you get a lot of eyeballs looking at your office, but it's a sucky idea if your staff and your patient is coming in and looking for a place to park, especially during the holiday. Okay, where your nearest parking space is like 60 spot out in the middle of the winter in Wisconsin. Right? So the site matters. Here's a prime example for I was talking to a potential client, and the building was designed, and we had a broker involved, and the broker was main interest is get you a lease, the best lease deal that you can. And Jim, you asked the question, is the broker or the realtor be a good fit to help with the design of the, of the park, of the site? The answer is no. The broker knew that the building was designed. Okay, it's already designed for this particular site. And never actually go to bat for the client on what can be done with the building so it can be best used on that property. Okay? For instance, I hope he's listening, is that this building has a trash dumpster that belonged to a restaurant next door that it cannot be moved. Well, part of the negotiation is you're getting the building, have it moved. Because it negatively affects the quality of and the perception of your office when your patient come out of the car and get a whiff of the restaurant trash. So the site matters, and until you sign the bottom line, negotiate until you get things taken care of. Jim?
Definitely. And, if you have to concede in some areas, then use that to your advantage so that you can at least financially get a serious reduction. And, you shouldn't pay top dollar for subpar. And without a doubt, one would hope that there's always other pieces of property. I mean, sure, I know that there's some places in the country that are so built up and you pretty much have to live with what you got and you just deal with the issues. And we understand that. We've had projects like that. We do projects like that all the time. But the norm, the majority are the opposite. the majority is you have options. And we've helped many of clients. For example, one of our clients over in Indiana looked at and evaluated the three different pieces of property. The first one that he was in love with actually was the very worst piece of property because, yeah, it was huge, but it wasn't really buildable because of issues, everything from floodplains to easements and setbacks and parking configurations and all the kinds of other things that really hindered that property, and ended up with, wow, that's a big piece of property if you just look at it. But in reality, we had to design a long, skinny building that would have fit on that thing, and it really wasn't a good solution.
It's too hidden back.
Exactly. It was just too many things that were bad against it, and so he rightly so passed on that property. Thank goodness he didn't go buy it and then call us.
I think what's important, and I hope that you'll walk away or take away from this, is this: the time to ask the question is before you sign. Okay, we have clients that that invest into the services. They know how that potential property is going to work. Once the assessment is done, and they can take that piece of information, they either negotiate and buy the property for cheaper if they feel that it's worth their while, or they can walk away from it. We had, if they buy the property, more likely we will be the architect. But if they buy the property and it's a bad piece of property, it wouldn't be right for them, and it wouldn't be right for us either. It's not a for us, it's a it's not a professional way to. It goes against our personal philosophy, and professional philosophy to watch our client get into a piece of property that's less than ideal. Okay? We have a curious prime example that we encountered, and Jim, I only want to take another minute or two with this, right? We have a potential client, looking at a piece of property. It sits at a corner, at an intersection. And the property, in conceptual-wise, it will fit for their building. The challenge is the surrounding. When you look at a property, you have to look at the surrounding property and the impact it has on you. What is on the property? It has a septic tank, so that's an extra money that you have to take, that you have to put into to get that out. Because the tremendous setback, a very deep setback on a very shallow property, it forces the building to be in one spot, only one spot, and that's before we know of anything else on the property, whether there's any easement that issues and things like that.
Right.
Okay, and it makes a property. It would limit you the new owner, how that property can be developed, and it's for us it's a negative, okay. But until you invest the money, it actually have the design, the preliminary site design done. Have no idea what it actually can do, will do, or should you sign and buy it or walk away. So invest into the service, find out. That's part of your due diligence.
And that's a pretty small investment. We're not talking about tens of thousands of dollars to be able to get an idea of a conceptual site plan. In relationship to the overall cost of the whole project, when potentially you could be saving hundreds of thousands of dollars because you've got a bad piece of property which has to have a whole lot of money sunk into it. And honestly, there is nothing worse than having to put money into a project that is buried underground or that is never seen. But it has to be done. To be able to develop that property. That's the worst feeling that we have when we see that a client has to do that. It's like, oh, gosh. It's like, proverbially pulling teeth, right, hon?
Yes, their teeth.
Yeah, unfortunately. All right. We've kind of gone through the, you know, bottom line is, I think you understand the answer to the question, why do you need a conceptual site plan? For all the reasons we just talked about. Well, let's go to another one here that we have been asked a bunch, and sometimes it comes across as a, well, yeah, but that's kind of self-serving. Well, let's talk about it. And the question is, why do I need an architect after I get the permit? We've heard that a bunch, don't we, Hunt?
We have. And the often the answer is, oh, but it would save me a ton of money, because I got the permit, the contractor can do it, you know, they'll take care of it, and it would save me a ton of money. That's what is being told to the owner. Okay, we hear it all the time.
Mostly from the builder.
Amen to that.
Yeah.
And why? If the person that tells you, you don't need an architect, I mean, we're the builder, we know what to do. So who does it benefit, really, Jim?
Well, you're right. Let's first talk about what does an architect do after the permit is done? And because I think it's important to understand the basis of, you know, what we're paid for. And we've had several shows that we've talked about a few of these things, but we'll just go through them. It is a pretty lengthy list of things that we are actually providing during that time. We're doing things like shop drawings. We're doing site observation. We're reviewing and answering any and all questions from all parties. That would be from the owner. That would be from the builder. That would be from the building departments. That would be from the plan review people. That would be from the engineers. Anybody that has any question about any aspect of that project as it's being built, the questions should come to us. Let's see, there's unforeseen situation when they start digging and they find something underground that was not known about. What happens? Well, the question comes to us, and then we orient it to the right entity to be able to determine what has to be done and then provide whatever necessary documents. So we're interpreting the drawings. We're interpreting when I say the observation, we're observing the construction so that it meets the quality and the design that was originally created. Okay. We're also doing observation for pay applications. Pay applications coming from the builder to us, eventually to you, and then off to the bank need to be certified to protect you. So along with where your eyes and ears to help back you up in anything and everything that comes around. So in construction, if a product or material is not available and another one has to be substituted, we evaluate that and we say, here's the issues with it, or here, yes, it will work, or no, it won't work, and here's why. We help in all of those aspects. So as I can say, and I probably missed a bunch of them, but that is a pretty lengthy list of things that are accomplished during the construction period of the project. Then culminates at the end of construction. We do the final walkthrough to make sure that the design intent was completed and that you've got from the builder what you paid for from the builder. To the point where you can say, okay, eventually you can get your certificate of occupancy and move into the building. And then on top of that, for a whole year, the project is under warranty from the builder. So if something comes up, we're there. We're there to support you. We're there to assist you. And we're there to help you out. And we get a lot of calls, don't we, Han? less than a year afterwards, we get a call. Well, this isn't working properly. How do I deal with it, or who do I call? So that's what we do during that time.
And, so, and we call, you know, we get called that's not necessarily a quality issue. You know, we get called as simple as
Jim? Yeah, something broke. The handle on the door going to the particular room doesn't work right. It won't lock. Who do I call? And it's not Ghostbusters.
Yeah, like, you know, I have scuffs on the floor, and I don't know what to, you know, how to clean it. You know, even those little things. Now, the main argument to whether you should have whether the architect should stay on the project to the end or not, often is they say, well, the contractor know what they're doing. For the most part, that's their job. They bid the project. That means that they had contractually signed on to build the building based on the design. Okay, they say they could. So yes, they better. But beyond that, there are the architect on the job. Is there to part of, you know, a part of the task is to make sure that the contractor is held accountable to the contract he signed with you. Here's just a small example. And it's not a big major deal, but it is. A flooring was specified by an interior designer. And the interior designer usually have their own. This particular interior designer have their own installer, but in this case, the contractor who are on the job does not work for the interior designer. They have never had any working relationship, and the interior designer is not familiar enough with the flooring where it's supposed to be a click-on system, and they say, oh, it fit better if you cut off all the tab. Wrong. You just voided all the contract. The contractor does not know enough about the material. He'd say, well, floor, you know, glue is glue, right? I went to the the big box, buy some flooring glue, and put it down. Well, the wrong glue for the wrong flooring makes it a mess for you, the owner, because the flooring will start to pop. And when it starts to peel, if it gets closer to your 365-day or 1 year warranty period, it will become your problem. It will become your problem anyway, way before that. So a contractor is not necessarily know everything. That's why there is a process in the construction administration process where the architect's involved, that the contractor provide every technical document possible associated with every building system, every material, to be cross-checked to make sure that he or she will buy and install what was specified, and what they're going to buy would actually work and would be warranted by the manufacturer. That's just a small piece of why the architect need to be involved.
But it's a very important piece, because those shop drawings that are produced and prepared and reviewed become part of the legal document along with the construction drawings that bind the builder to the construction process and the construction contract. So if the proverbial crap hits the fan and you have a failure of whatever particular issue, you then have documentation to back up what was done or not done. So, you know, the examples are, well, sure, you might end up being a situation where you end up going to court and having to deal with that, but what do you have to support your side? You know, what's your attorney going to ask? What do you have to support your side? Well, if you have the documents, if you have the construction drawings, if you have the shop drawings, if you have the pay applications, if you have all those necessary things that we make sure that are provided, we don't make them, but we make sure that they come through us and we review them. And if all those things are there, you have a pile of supporting information that will help your case. Again, looking out for your best interest, not just during the design, but during the construction and after the fact. So, you know, it's a three-pronged kind of approach, but it's very valuable. In essence, the age-old question that the architectural services are not needed because we're going to save you money is actually very false. It's not going to save you money by keeping the architect off the job. It's potentially going to cost you tens of thousands of dollars down the road. For what? A small percentage of the total architectural fee? Is that worth it? I mean, you look at it. Juan, you and I were talking about it. Insurance salesmen or saleswomen sell fear, okay? We're not selling fear here. We're selling reality. And the issue is, are our services during that time good insurance? We think so.
Yeah.
Very good insurance. You'll spend a lot more on a big life insurance policy than you will on the little bit of money that's part of the percentage of the architectural fee to keep the architect on during construction. And you will probably never even know what you lost in quality in the construction because the checks and balances are gone. And when those checks and balances are gone, unfortunately, some unscrupulous builders have been known to cut corners and change materials, go with more inferior stuff, and basically give you less bang for your buck. And on top of that, telling you that they saved you money.
Yeah, it's usually the fear is it saves you money. There is a thing that every architect on a project, every engineer on a project, they're professionally trained and licensed and insured. Things they do have to not just work. Things they do and design for the building have to also be in compliance with the code and the law. So when they place a piece of equipment in the building, it has to be in accordance with the applicable code. For instance, things that are not commonly known. Let's say you have when you build a building and a contractor say to you, the owner, you know, I can put this this condenser on the roof right by the right here on the edge of the building. It's a shorter run. It costs you less to run all the wiring and the condensate line and all that stuff. So it saves you money. And you, the owner, would say, yeah, that makes sense. Okay. The problem is the building code do not allow you to put a piece of serviceable equipment on the roof within 10 feet from the edge of the roof. So
without,
if you don't know that.
Without putting up a handrail to protect the potential of any, a guardrail, you're right. Without putting up a guardrail, which is higher than a handrail, you're exactly correct. To protect any individual up there servicing that piece of equipment from falling off the building. Well, who saved money where? Don't know.
Actually, it will cost you more because once it's put down, Okay, once it's placed, there's a hole or two that have been drilled to the roof. Now that piece of equipment has to be disconnected, relocated, and all of the lines, wiring, plumbing, piping, all that now need to be either taken out or extended. And then all the holes need to be patched. So if you don't have proper guidance on or advocate on your project, the architect or the engineer, you approve that. If you approve that, now you're going to have to pay for it to be relocated. Okay.
Yep. Or the guardrail installed, and then you have to live with the ugly guardrail sticking up on the side of your building. And heaven forbid it's right at the front of your building. You know, so you got a beautiful new building with this guardrail sticking up there. And in a lot of municipalities, guardrails have to be painted a god-awful either yellow or red.
That would be pretty.
That's pretty. Yeah.
we're being
facetious, right, hon? It's not pretty.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
It's not attractive.
But you see, we hear that all the time. The contractor know what they're doing. Okay? Yes, most of them do. If you're lucky enough, you get one that doesn't. Okay? So here's another example,
because we got about five more minutes, and I want to at least throw this one in there too, Han, is that during the construction, if everything, unfortunately, you get the perfect storm and things go pretty badly, and the contractor is failing to perform. And there could be a whole lot of areas where they fail to perform. One, they bite off more than they can chew, and they're not able to put enough people on the job to keep it on schedule. Or two, they put the wrong people on the job, and the subcontractors that are working for them are doing subpar work. Or three, the contractor gets into a financial situation and isn't paying subcontractors because of other issues, maybe not related to your building at all, could be other projects, and they effectively go belly up. All three of those cases could potentially cause you to have to terminate your contract with the builder, and then what do you do? If you don't have an architect on the team because they weren't needed and you could save some money, you have no continuity between the beginning of that project through to the completion, and you've got to now find a new builder to be able to pick up for where that old builder left off. Hopefully you have the right amount of money still kept into the project to be able to finish it, along with retainage and all that other fun stuff that exists in the pay applications. So, again, we're not selling fear here. We're selling reality. And it's cheap, cheap, cheap insurance. On?
Yeah, it's probably one of the worst nightmares that you can run that you can encounter. Because if you...
Yeah.
Often very few contractors that are intelligent would say, hey, I'd love to take on that other guy's problem and solve it for you. Because it's a different, they would assume somebody else's liability. Here's another item that goes into this discussion too. When the architect is not involved in the project, after the permit, let's say if you approve a proposal change or a proposed change presented to you by the contractor, and that change effectively costs the project or that particular element, that change element, to be a non-compliant, whether it's a building system or wall system or whatever it is that causes a non-compliant issue, there's wiggle room for the architect to simply say, we no longer are liable for the technical aspect of this building, this project. because we did not approve that alteration or that change. It did not went to us. And that applied to the architect and the engineer. Jim?
Well, I can tell you, Han, without a doubt, in our particular situation, the way HJT works is that if we are not part of the construction process, we will require a release of liability for the project, just for that reason, because we're not able to protect and or maintain the integrity of the design from the beginning through the end. And so we have no control over what is actually put into the building. And so if the building system fails and we're drug into a litigation, we're not going to take that liability to say, okay, yeah, we have some liability here because we originally designed it this way when something else was placed in it unbeknownst to us. So without a doubt, you forfeit in our particular case, and you'll find that probably in a majority of any other architectural firms, that you'll forfeit the liability coverage that you would be given under a normal architect owner contract if you fail to keep the architect on through construction. So, but that's a very good point. So you're basically at a higher risk level down the road.
It's an investment in protecting your interests. Not out of fear. It's actually protect your interests and the longevity and quality of your investment, the building.
Right, exactly.
Jim?
Well, we've blown through two questions and a whole hour. Like always, Han and I talk too much sometimes, but hopefully it's been informative. It has given you some more facts. So that down the road, if you find yourself in a situation where somebody's asking you to do something, you'll say, ah, I remember when Han and Jim talked about that. And at least you have that in your database that you can then say, maybe I don't want to do this, or maybe I do want to do this based upon what you heard tonight. So we're, again, very, very thankful that you are part of the, you know, the HJT community. You want to spend your time listening to what we have to say, basically what we believe. And always, please, if you have a question, if you have a concern, if you have a thought, you know, send it in. We'll do our best to try to answer it. And if not personally and directly, we'll try to do it over the airway if it's something that we feel that everybody will be able to, you know, gain from. We're looking forward to hopefully a really interesting show next week. We're trying to line up a special guest that'll be part of the show. We'll let you know more about that. Hopefully that comes to happen. And with that, Han, I'm going to let you have the last word.
Jim, I do believe that we have confirmation that will work for next episode. So our guest will be on the show.
Excellent.
We can't tell you. Yeah, we can't tell you what it's about because we don't want to be a spoiler. But it will be it would be an interesting program. We learned a lot from speaking with our guest the other day. So anyway,
we can tell you that he is a dentist. Okay.
That's right.
And yeah, he is a dentist, and it is going to be. Well, Han and I, we kind of look at this when we first saw what the doc was showing us, and it's like, this could be a game changer. This could be a game changer, and it has to do with COVID. So I'll put you at that amount of, what do I call that? The tease?
The trailer.
The trailer, yes.
Anyway, yeah, don't give it away yet, Jim. Okay?
Nope, I didn't.
All right, very good. I have a great time. I know Jim does too. Again, we are passionate, very passionate about the things that we do in the field of architecture. And we love to share our knowledge that help you so you make the right decision with or without us. We like it to be with us. But anyway, it will be useful for you. If not right away, it will. So with that, I appreciate you spending the time with us. Stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll talk to you again till next time. Have a great evening.
You've been listening to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk with Jim and Han. To contact us and find out more info about upcoming shows, please log on to our website at www.hjtdesign.com. Until next time.